darkly splendid abodes, the official podcast of Toronto Thelema, exploring, if you will, practical philosophy, from science and the workings of the mind to spirituality, esotericism, and magic. Stooping down, dipping my wings, I came into the darkly splendid abodes. The so-called false Sephira on the Tree of Life, called Da'av, and the magician and author Kenneth Grant share something in common. Beginners are often warned against pursuing interest in either of them by those who feel such interest will prove unhealthy or dangerous. But Edward Mason and I will discuss Da'av with reference to Kenneth Grant to see what comes through for us. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. Welcome, Edward.
Love is the law, love under will.
Thanks for joining me as usual. How are you doing?
We're doing pretty good here in Mexico. We're just masses of torrential rain, but we needed that because we've had a drought. So I'm complaining even though I probably shouldn't do so. One or the other option, either complaining like hell or saying it's wonderful, must conform to my true will. So if I say both of them, then I've somehow aligned myself with what I need to do.
You operate from the mean where you're just kind of like, eh.
It's the word of the next day on.
Yeah. And the word of the ensuing quarter is, yes. Yeah, so we wanted to talk about, from what I understand, it was the abyss or something pertaining thereunto.
Well, I wanted to talk about Da'av. I don't know that I could really give an authoritative account of the abyss. Never actually, so far as I know, having been through it, unless I was kicked out because of whatever reason. I'm going to blame this one on you because you suggested doing something about chaos and Babylon. And I thought I could talk about that for 5 minutes. Then I don't know that I could go on past that. Da'av, on the other hand, is a very strangely ambiguous thing in Kabbalistic teachings. And I thought, I like Kabbalistic ambiguities because that means I can go on about them for ages. And since it's ambiguous, if I say the wrong thing, it doesn't matter because, you know, somebody's going to agree with me. Let's just, you know, for people who can't quite remember their Tree of Life off the top, you've got Malkuth, the kingdom, which is here, this place, you know, physical incarnation, right down at the bottom. You've got Yesod, the Sephira of the moon, and the foundations of the psyche right above that. Then you have Hod and Netzach right above that. And any book you get by Israel Righardi, William Gray, Dion Fortune, Gareth Knight, they'll all tell you 90% the same stuff about those Sephiroth. It's very well understood. Your actual personal experience of them will be unique to you, but you'll be able to understand it in terms of the standard element to ascribe to each one of those Sephiroth and the standard sorts of experiences you would have in Hod, which is more intellectually oriented, Netzach, which is much more to do with the intuitive level of emotion and feeling and beginning to tune into deeper stuff. Then you've got Tifereth in the middle, the nice yellow sphere. The fun one in the middle. If people are very Christian in their orientation, they'll go on about how there you encounter Christ consciousness. I don't think people really talk that much anymore about meeting Jesus Christ there. They're talking about a state of mind, a state of understanding, of a new comprehension, which really energizes and expands all you understand. Still pretty standard stuff. Then you've got Gevura, which is severity. It's dealing with your karma and doing karmic work and slogging through, even though it's kind of grim going. And on the other side, you've got Chesed, which means mercy or compassion, or Gedula, its other name, which means majesty. So it's kind of, you know, if you do enough Gevura, you can make it over the other side. And then you would be what is referred to as an exempt adept. It's all pretty standard stuff. Now, what happens after that is where it gets interesting. And one of the fundamental differences that I still see between the older schools of Hermetic teaching and Thelema is that Thelema is saying, hey, that there's stuff up above us here that we need to get to. Mm-hmm. Whereas all of the older schools kind of say, well, there's this sort of strange division point that we really can't understand between these lower seven sephiroth and the supernal triangle at the top, which is all kind of abstract and ideal, and we can't know much about it. So that if you are going, for example, to Dion Fortune's The Mystical Kabbalah, there was an addition put in about 26 years ago, I assume either by Gareth Knight, who had inherited that tradition more or less, along with Dolores Ashcroft Novitsky, or by one of Knight's students, where they start talking about what it is to be in touch with that level of things. But that's Da'ath, which is this funny non-sephira that lives in the abyss or is above the abyss or floating in the vicinity thereof. So you find people saying that you can sort of push into Da'ath, and that's kind of it. You shouldn't and you can't really go further than what I've just said, because really human beings can't be there. There's a great deal about Da'ath being linked to justice in Gareth Knight's stuff, in Fortune, a little bit in Paul Case, and so on and so forth. Da'ath is often referred to as a kind of point of equilibrium, or the child of Chokhmah, which is this outpouring of tremendously potent energy, which is absorbed, not destroyed, not stopped, not blocked, but absorbed by Bina, which is understanding. And there's a tremendously important doctrine there. The outpouring is understood. It is not rejected. It is not criticized. It's taken in completely. This is part of why we refer to Babylon as the sacred whore, because she doesn't refuse anything that comes at her from Chokhmah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Da'ath is this thing in the middle there, kind of hovering. It's not a sephira in the ordinary sense. So you've got people saying that, you learn a lot about what's there through simply dealing with Da'ath as a point of equilibration, and you are dealing with spiritual communication. And I'm going to get back to the balance point there in a second, because I think this is where we might be looking at the content of the next aeon after the current aeon of Horus. That's quite a way down the line, but we'll look at that. Now, Crowley, in around about 1909, 1910, when he finally published in Equinox Volume 5, The Vision and the Voice, created a huge scandal because he said, I literally went over the abyss.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not just that Crowley was a controversial guy with, a rather sensational sex life who was, provoking all kinds of things and making people think, he's not the right sort of chap really at all. No. He'd actually said he'd done this. And it's understanding what is meant by that that I think clarifies what Da'ath is. Right up until through Gevura and Chesed, you're dealing with what Kabbalists call the Ruach. That is the individuality. It's the roots of one's separate nature. And that's the Ruach. So the word refers to both spirit and breath. It's known territory. However deep into yourself you go, however much Jung you've absorbed, you're still dealing with the individual self.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this idea that you cannot go beyond that. And the answer is yes, that's right. But beyond the Ruach is the supernal soul, the intuitive mind. You're dealing with the Neshama, which is a much higher level of consciousness, if you can even call it a level. At this point, you are into the transpersonal side of things. You are into
Well, it's like you were saying, you can't go beyond this point. And if you, it's like flipping the emphasis, you can't go beyond this point.
Yes.
So that's where the transpersonal part comes in.
Exactly. You then become Nemo, no man. No man can go over the abyss because, or no woman as well, obviously. Mm-hmm. Neymar would be the female. This is an opening to something that is completely beyond what we know as human beings, having some kind of relation with a spiritual perspective, with God, with the divine, with Bodhi, with higher consciousness, whatever. There is a fundamental and permanent shift here. And Crowley himself, after he'd gone through those Enochian invocations that produced the vision and the voice, said that for about a year, he had no idea what to do with himself. He couldn't pull it together. Stabilizing in the grade is always a little tough. But here he was just stumped. It was so much beyond anything that he'd come across. Despite the fact he'd done some serious yogic work, he'd done a lot of deep magic. He was a brilliant man, and he'd written some really penetrating philosophical stuff. He was just beyond anything he could handle. Other schools don't do this. As I say, they tend to have this idea that you sort of go as far as Darth and download information from that point onward. And obviously, you can see the threat there. Crowley says people who won't cross the abyss are the Black Brothers. They are, in fact, the enemies of humankind. Yeah, in a way, because they're saying, oh, it's too dangerous to go there. Don't do that. Mm-hmm. And Crowley's saying, oh, give it a shot. But even he is very clear in more than a few places that if you're trying to work towards knowledge and conversation, usually your first few stabs at that are going to kind of fall flat. It's beyond you. You have to surrender to a guidance that you're probably rejecting all the way down the line. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you actually try to cross the abyss, you can really screw up completely and fail to complete the crossing. Crowley suggests that George Cecil Jones didn't fully make it over when they met some years after the founding of the AA and they'd been apart for a time. Jones was just talking about his family and his kids. That may simply have been a way of Jones saying, look, I ran into some difficulties in my life because of you, Alistair. I'm just going to back off a bit. We don't know the full story there at all. But Darth still remains this odd thing that you can't really define. Or if you do, every definition I came across was quite different. One thing, of course, is that there is a link between Darth and Yesod. Yesod is where you are emerging from simple, mundane physical consciousness to the first sense that there is a magical, a symbolic, a deeper, an astral world beyond your current comprehension. Darth is the gateway to the ultimate, well, not the ultimate, but the very high level stuff up at the top of the tree. Mm-hmm. You'll notice when Crowley was crossing the abyss, he refers to things like the nine towers on the abyss, the demon Charonza, and all of this mental distraction, which of course is one, maybe not definition, but one aspect of Darth, masses and masses of information pouring out utterly irrelevantly. Charonzon's name is enumerated as 333. 3 + 3 + 3 = 9. Again, it's a reference to the ninth Sephira, Yesod. And you find this kind of alternation between the two. There's an interesting parallel between them. One guy that you can't ignore with Darth stuff is Kenneth Grant, who was promoted too soon, too early by Crowley because Crowley was dying when the two men met. And I think Grant is an absolutely fascinating and creative person. I always wish that I'd met the guy, somebody who went into territory that nobody else had, and many people might be advised not to follow him, but the man is compelling. If anybody wants to check it online, there is a review of Against the Light by one of Grant's novels or narratives. You know, the line between fiction and nonfiction with Grant is a rather vague one. And Alan Moore wrote this 25 years ago. Alan Moore is, of course, a magician himself. He's quite public about it. Also the author of V for Vendetta, The Watchmen from Hell, and other pieces of fiction. I think it's one of the most brilliant things that I have read about any magical adventurer, his review. It's hilarious. It's on the money. And it also points out that every serious magician has some Grant material on their bookshelf. Grant went up to Duff, and it's like he doesn't go any further, because then he's looking at the tunnels of Set, which are the inverse of the paths of the Tree of Life. Now, if I understand him correctly, basically he's saying that all the things we dumb to be evil and dark and terrifying are simply to do with our relationship with the ultimate emptiness of all phenomena. The mind rebels against such things, and from each specific angle that we take on the nothingness, which of course is Nuit, we tend to respond to it by producing mental phenomena, mental symbols, mental content that is pretty horrible and ghastly. And in Grant's own universe, it's quite explicitly H.P. Lovecraftish. Which sounds absurd, but the more you look at Grant, the more you realize he had a serious purpose here. I do think that it's far easier to discover the emptiness of things by using the standard techniques of magic or Tibetan Buddhism or Hindu Advaita Vedanta. And Grant himself was into Advaita Vedanta very much all through his life. So, fascinating guy and worth knowing, but, you know, it's kind of like, don't try this at home until you've been doing this stuff for 15 years, because you might make a huge mess. I mention all of this because he's giving us a more complete idea of what happens in Darth. It's one thing after another after another. Again, I mentioned the nine towers on the abyss, the 333 for the name of Coronzon. Grant himself produced three trilogies of novels. You know, nine. You're sold. You get it? Nudge, nudge. He doesn't say this explicitly. Alan Moore points it out in his review of Against the Light. But there is this relationship between the two. So you've got this thing where the standard sort of post-Golden Dawn school, mostly out of Britain, but also Paul Case, tends to say you go up to Darth and you sort of wait piously to receive input from this level of things that tells you, you know, mystical stuff. And I don't think that's a terribly bad thing to do, unless you're dishonest with yourself and think, you know, I'm too scared to go ahead, so I'll just accept this as the limit. But what you're dealing with is something that equilibrates, as I said at the beginning, Chokmah and Binah. Now, there's this whole sort of mystery that people love to speculate on. The whole thing in chapter 3 of the Book of the Law, verse 34. But your holy place shall be untouched through the centuries. Though with fire and sword it be burnt down and shattered, yet an invisible house there standeth, and shall stand until the fall of the great equinox, when Hrumachis shall arise and the double-wanded one assume my throne and place. Now, everyone's got the idea that Hrumachis is kind of a Maat figure or Themis figure who's going to come in and take the throne. Hrumachis is simply a Greek way of rendering the name Rahu Akuit, which really, you know, is. So what he's saying here is actually Hrumachis is going to get up and welcome the successor and say, you know, marvelous to see you. Have a great day on. And things change. Now, the double-wanded thing is a bit confusing because not much further down, verse 72 of the same chapter, there's a reference to the Lord of the double wand of power, the wand of the force of Kophnia. And that's one of those difficult verses that Rose Kelly filled in for Crowley after Crowley had failed to hear the original text. Mm-hmm. And some people have said, well, Kophnia, it looks like N-I-A is I-E, nothing, and C-O-P-H could be Sof, En-Sof, the endlessness. She didn't realize that Hebrew would be written left to right, so she's getting it the wrong way around in her head. I think you just have to kind of take a stab at it and say that Horus Hrumachis has the Was scepter, the scepter of dominion, in his right hand and an empty left hand, whereas what comes after is doing something more balanced than that. You have to figure out your own answer because the verses are contradictory here. But certainly, as late as the 1940s, when Crowley was designing the Thoth tarot deck with Frieda Harris, they came up with the Aeon card, and there's the image of Mart at the bottom with the, you know, there's a little Libra symbol. So obviously he knew that this, or still believed implicitly, that a Libra, Mart, balance, Themis thing was going to come in afterwards. Mm-hmm. So there's all this stuff in the Society of the Inner Light in Britain, some of it in Paul Case's work with Builders of the Adytum and their successor groups, that implies that there's this justice thing in Da'ath. And I think what they're telling us is that people who get that far at a future point are actually going to be dealing with a Mart process that actually takes consciousness to the point where Neshama can intrude or saturate understanding, and that's going to be a future stage of human evolution. A few people, yes, starting with Aleister Crowley, have been over the abyss. I know one person that I think has done so remarked to me about 10 years ago that maybe there were 50 or 60 masters of the temple on the planet. I think he was including people from non-Hermetic schools. So it's there, it's begun, but it's not going to be the predominant thing. The real thing in this aeon is getting knowledge and conversation at Tefereth, then developing that down to its essence through Gevurah, then expanding it again in Chesed, and that's probably more than a lifetime's work for most people.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of interesting, the idea of justice and Mott and those kinds of associations with that particular area, too, because like you were mentioning in our last talk from Chapter 3 of Liber 65, the idea of the green circle that encircles the universe, that bounds the universe. And I was feeling like it sort of gets referenced from time to time, and I kind of feel like there's like a Libra kind of association going on with it. And that just sort of thinking of it as that point being the limit of our personal universe, at the very least, it's kind of an interesting association. It's kind of adds a different level to that.
Definitely. I think we probably have to assume that all future aeons are already present to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. But the actual level of mass realization is shifting at the present time. Simply the push towards knowledge and conversation, which is happening on a very deep, you know, archetypal, collective level, is going to produce all kinds of bizarre phenomena, not just positive stuff with magical adepts popping up all over the place. You're going to have people with an incomplete understanding. You're going to have people with a rather fascistic religious understanding, and so on and so on. Mm-hmm. But that's what we're actually dealing with at the moment, attempting to get our global society through an increasingly scary and painful transformation that's happening, to the point where we are beginning to understand better that we are individuals in relation to a cosmos, as opposed to individuals in relation to just other individuals.
Mm-hmm.
That's not easy stuff.
Hmm.
Even Crowley himself, after he'd become a master, I think he says somewhere in the Confessions maybe about, I still have to remind myself at times that, you know, it's all part of one vast ongoing manifestation. That those aren't the words he uses, but that's the sense of it. That he was more or less anchored in his master of the temple consciousness, that his neshama had gone through the Bina experience and then 7 or 8 years later began moving over to the Chokhma consciousness or supraconsciousness that ended up with him as a magus, which is where he really did most of his, all of his work for the rest of his life.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we're having a very difficult time creating that total sense of here we are in relation to the cosmos.
Mm.
You know, we're more ecologically conscious, some people. There's also a tremendous resistance to ecology. It's like, oh, it's wussy liberalism and you're trying to take down our beautiful oil industry, or, you know, squabbles on that level. We are more conscious of the vastness of the cosmos that we're in, the physical one. And at the same time, there's a huge denial that not anything could be that old. There's a more and more creationists popping up all the time. More and more flat earthers are like, no, don't push this at me. I'm going to go right back. I don't want to know about this. Don't tell me. It's all wrong. It's all lies, etc., etc.
Well, you know, that's fascinating, too, because it's, you know, 10, 15 years ago, that would have seemed like a ridiculous concept that people would, you know, you'd get more, like an increasing number of people with that kind of mentality rather than the inverse. But I would say that kind of shatters our preconceptions about the way that "quote unquote evolution works in the sense of you know, we've had the industrial revolution, and ever since then we just keep looking forward and thinking that things just progress constantly, as if that were possible or something.
Yeah, a thing I often cite to people is what I call the futurist fallacy. Back in the 80s, when I was doing trade magazine editing, every conference I went to, they bring in a futurist who would tell us how things were going to go in future. And they'd have a graph, and you know, up would come the PowerPoint presentation or whatever we had in the 80s. And the line just went up, 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 up in a straight line. And I think nothing goes like that. You know, things go up and then down, up and then down and up and then down. And obviously there is this very, you know, knowledge and conversation looks like a really cool idea till you start realizing that you are going to have this collision with something that is a far greater source of information, including kinds of information that you'd really find a little difficult to accept. It's an invasion of self that happens with knowledge and conversation. However hard you've worked for it, when it actually pops, then it's like, oh my Lord, I wasn't expecting that. And obviously it's so different for every single person that you can't just, you know, lay down the ground rules, which is why, you know, there is no such thing as a definition of it. But there you are, people working through this to the point that some people are able to attain the stability and equilibrium to allow in that kind of guidance bit by bit, step by step, you know, forward and back, then a bit more forward, a little bit back, and even more forward until finally there is whatever kind of intersection between supernal consciousness and personal consciousness is going to happen for that person. Then, of course, the rest of their life is spent on expanding that understanding. But most people are going to rebel like hell. Most of us dig in and say no. I mean, I find having been in fairly senior positions in different three fraternities now, people come up with wonderful excuses as why they can't continue. Mm. But you realize you're scared of something we said. Something fundamentally goes against what your parents told you, what they told you in church, or they told you, you know, from whatever source you derive your authority for a comprehending life. And that's one of the things that we have to work through in this aeon till it really fully becomes established. And I think that is a key factor in what's rocking the world at the moment, in that there's all these centrifugal forces, but very, very little in the way of a coherent international narrative to move us into a place of greater safety. Rather, the institutions are breaking down, just as the book of the law tells us it's going to happen. And we are facing this difficulty of getting ourselves to a point where at least each individual person is getting this tuning in to where things have to go. And you can't, if you're doing that, be too worried about where things are going collectively. You just have to let things move where they are moving, but do your own bit to bring yourself to that understanding, or the first stages of it. What happens when we actually get much, much further on to Darth, I can only hint at today, because I haven't any idea myself beyond the stuff I've already quoted. I just think that it's a fascinating journey to realize that something up ahead is totally beyond what we can understand in a world where we're worried about ecological problems, environmental extremes, wars breaking out all over the place, and of course the latest bugbear, artificial intelligence. You know, will there be any magicians when everything becomes part of a purported singularity? I'm not sure the singularity is actually a viable idea in terms of silicon-based computing systems, but you know, we'll have to see exactly how that one goes.
Mm-hmm. Wow. a lot to think about.
Well, it is a time of thinking. Everything is up for grabs. The one specific thing that Crowley says about, or wrote about, Darth is Liber os abismi vel Darth. And that is strictly a set of instructions for somebody preparing to cross the abyss. You know, saturate yourself with philosophy. You know, he lists Berkeley, Hume, Kant, Hegel, and of course himself. And you have to restrict yourself purely to intellectual analysis of all this, which of course breaks under the stress of its inability to go beyond itself.
Yeah, even if it brings you to the brink of having a breakdown and then having to wait until your next incarnation to be able to move on forward.
Yeah, somewhere I think it's either in the text itself or a comment underneath, he says, most people are brought to the brink of insanity, and this could well be the end of their career to attain gnosis. Thanks, Alistair. You're a pal.
Listening. Look for Toronto Thelema on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Watch for events in the city. And join us again in the darkly splendid abodes.